Chapter 14, The Conference Committee, Ground Zero. Minnesota teachers saw charters as threatening to all, not empowering for some. Conference Committee, mid-May, 1991. In the bicameral system, conference committees wield a lot of power. Conferees can change the course and impact of an issue in a single vote. That's why some, particularly proponents of unicameral legislatures, have called the conference committee the third house. An omnibus funding bill, whether it be for education, human services, environment, economic development, or any other area, is also known as an appropriations or budget bill. The top leaders of the House and Senate negotiate the amount of the state budget that can be spent in each omnibus funding bill. Once that amount is set, conferees negotiate how they wish to spend the allotted funds. When drafted, omnibus funding bills can exceed 400 pages. They can include hundreds or even thousands of provisions for review, which include specific appropriation line items and related policy changes. Chartering would be a related policy change in the education omnibus funding bill. Many provisions will be different between the House and Senate, reflecting the distinct funding and policy priorities of the legislative bodies. The task of the conferees is to painstakingly review the differences and hammer out a final compromise for the overall bill. They can propose numerous amendments to either the House or Senate positions to ensure the compromise will be acceptable to a majority of members from both houses. Usually, the legislative leaders allot a minimum of a week or 10 days near the end of the legislative session for funding conference committees to do their work. It is hard work. Some of the conference committee's work is done in public, but often the House and Senate funding chairs meet in private to narrow the issues and provide an outline to their common goal. The final week of a conference committee is an arduous time, with meetings often occurring day and night and throughout the weekends. Conferees may work two or three nights in a row with little sleep. Despite this intense responsibility, legislators prize an appointment to a major funding conference committee. Five members from each House negotiate the omnibus funding bills. The House and Senate funding division chairs work as co-chairs of the conference committee. Each serves as author of his or her respective funding bill and recommends favored appointees for the four other conferees. These appointees generally reflect the partisan balance of each House. In 1991, that meant each co-chair would generally recommend three DFL members and one Republican. In 1991, I served as chair of the Property Tax Division of the Senate Tax Committee and would therefore serve on the Tax Conference Committee. Since senators are generally appointed to just one budget-related conference committee, I would not have a seat on the Omnibus Education Funding Conference Committee. In my view, that was fine. I was too close to the chartering issue, and my colleagues could make the case for chartering just as well as I during conference committee discussions. I knew I would be kept in the loop on any proposed changes to the chartering provisions. For any conference committee, the appointments don't just happen by accident. I couldn't have been more pleased with the appointed members of the 1991 Omnibus Education Funding Bill Conference Committee. The co-chairs were, of course, the funding division chairs, Senator Ron Dicklich of Hibbing and Representative Ken Nelson of South Minneapolis. Dicklich continued to be steadfast in his support of chartered schools. Indeed, the bill would not have gotten as far as it did without his support. And Nelson had been involved in the charter issue with me for 3 years. As expected, the four other Senate conferees were solid in their support of chartering. They were DFLers Senator Greg Dahl of Ham Lake, chair of the Education Committee, who had been, coincidentally, my classmate at St. Olaf College, Senator Gary DeCramer from rural Ghent, and Senator Sandra Pappas from the St. Paul district surrounding the Capitol. Pappas's interest in chartered schools reflected the concerns of the urban coalitions and communities of color, who saw opportunity with these new autonomous schools. The final Senate member was Republican Senator Jen Olson of suburban Minnetrista. Olson was a leading Republican member of the Education Committee, and we knew each other well as first-termers in the Senate class of 1982. Beginning in 1988, she'd been a solid bipartisan partner in the chartering bill. Indeed, as both Olson and I have often recounted, the chartering legislation would not have become law without strong bipartisan support. On the House side, the fate of chartering legislation in conference committee would be determined by one person, the Speaker of the House, who had sole power to appoint House conferees. In addition to co-chair Nelson, Representative Becky Kelso, the author of the House chartering legislation, was appointed conferee. The two other DFL House conferees did not support chartering. They were Representative Bob McCarran and Representative Jerry Bowerly, an assistant majority leader from Sauk Rapids. Bowerly served as the vice chair of the Education Finance Division and, according to Vanasek, was a rising star and one of the newer members who had a lot of influence over the other members. The fifth House conferee was Republican Representative Gary Schaefer from Gibbon. In his March 2011 interview, Vanasek explained that Schaefer represented the deciding vote for chartering. Schaefer supported chartering. This was not a coincidence. With Kelso, Schaefer, and Nelson as chair, the three House votes needed to finally adopt the chartering provisions from the Senate bill into the conference committee report seemed, for the first time, very real. Even before the 10 conferees met for the first time in early May 1991, opponents within the education community mobilized. Their mission was to kill the chartering bill by quashing it in the conference committee for the third year in a row. Failing that, they would attempt to weaken the Senate legislation by amending it. Outside the Capitol, opponents were even approaching those who supported charters. On May 3, 1991, Ted Coldery wrote me, "We've had a kind of funny thing happen. Two teachers who've been supporters of the bill have now told me that they've had Minneapolis school people ask them about it. In one case, it was an administrator saying to Barb Schmidt, 'I hear you gave some testimony on charter schools.' In the other case, it was a Minneapolis school board member saying to one of the interested teachers, Lana Ellison, 'I saw your name on a list of people supporting charter schools.' The list came to her from the School Boards Association." Opponents were organizing quickly and aggressively on multiple levels. In the first week of May, the Minnesota Federation of Teachers, MFT, sent a flyer to all its school building representatives. In short order, a supporter gave me a copy. The flyer included a list of the names and phone numbers of the 10 conference committee members and read, "We're concerned and you should be too. There is legislation that could jeopardize seniority rights as well as salaries and benefits. Establish charter schools which would not be required to operate under the same rules and regulations as public schools. Subtract dollars from public school districts' general funds. Allow unlicensed personnel to take positions that currently require a teaching license. We need you to act today. Call members of the conference committee and tell them to vote no on the charter school bill." Unknown to me, Terry Lydell, a teacher at Robbinsdale Cooper High School in my district and a supporter of the chartering legislation, crafted a response to the conferees. He shared a copy with me dated May 11, 1991. "Attached is a copy of a flyer sent to all Minnesota Federation of Teachers building representatives. It contains some misleading information and one outright lie. I am bringing this to your attention because I believe that you, as a legislator, should know what measures are being taken to influence your vote on the charter school issue. Before I detail the issues, I feel that you should know four things. First, I am a member of the Federation of Teachers and the MEA. Second, I served on the writing team that helped draft the charter school bill, so I am familiar with the paradigm, concept, and language. Third, I am a classroom teacher in a program for dropout students. Fourth, I support a charter school bill. Lydell then responded in detail to each of the MFT's concerns about seniority, waiver of rules and regulations, loss of dollars, and unlicensed teachers. To the last point, he was especially bold in taking on the union leadership. This very simply is not true. The charter bill calls for licensed teachers, period. When I discussed this item with an MFT representative, she said she knew that Senator Reichscott had dropped the unlicensed provision from the bill, but the conferees might put it in. Might? The flyer doesn't say might. This statement misleads the reader on an issue that is extremely important to education professionals. In my opinion, that is unethical. It is a breach of faith for the MFT Executive Board to mislead the membership. That issue becomes more complex when its results are visited upon you as a legislator as you go about trying to do the right thing. Coincidentally, at the same time the MFT flyer was generating discussion, President Albert Schenker of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, came back to Minnesota to speak at a St. Paul meeting of AFT and National School Board members. The meeting was about the new school district-initiated Saturn School of Tomorrow, a break-the-mold school in St. Paul. Coldery attended Schenker's informal discussion on May 9th and sent me these notes quoting Schenker's conversation. And I'm convinced that we in education, too, are not going to do the hard things needed to change the schools unless we have to, unless there are consequences. Something has to be at stake. There is in other fields. Your organization could fail. People in these fields dislike change, too, but they have to do it. We in education don't. Because for us, nothing is at stake. If our kids do brilliantly, nothing good happens. And if we don't push, we can count on remaining popular with our colleagues. We have got to deal with this question of consequences for adults. Educators simply are not going to take the risks of change against the pressures of everyday popular feelings unless they have to. We do need something to happen that is truly revolutionary. When a teacher in the audience asked, "How does that happen?" Schenker replied, "I'm not an optimist. I don't expect unions to come out for incentives and rewards. I can do it because I'm retirement age. But we're not going to have what we have now much longer. It doesn't work, and everybody knows it doesn't work. A lot of educators don't think they are affected. They think they're not threatened by the pressures that are building. They're dead wrong." In another coincidence, Nelson had his own contact with the AFT president during this time. In his 2011 interview, Nelson related this story. "When we got into the debate about charter schools in conference committee, the Minnesota Federation of Teachers was against it and made it very clear they were against it. I would say, 'Well, Schenker supports this, you know.' McCarran would challenge that and get upset about that. So I went and called Schenker. I happened to get him on the phone right before he was leaving on a trip. I said, 'Hey, we've launched this charter school idea based on your idea, but your local unions out here are beating up on us. What's going on?'" As Nelson recalls, Schenker said, "Well, the structure of the AFT is to kind of let the locals decide their own destiny." Nelson added that Schenker said he still remained convinced that it was a viable experiment, but he left it at that. The locals had their own freedom and their own point of view on things like this. I didn't know back in 1991 about Nelson's conversation with Schenker, but at the time, I did reflect on the stark contrast between the language of the local MFT flyer and Coldery's notes from the national AFT president, all happening the same week. Schenker was right. In Minnesota, educators were resisting the risks of change, and the conferees were certainly hearing about it. This dissonance was awkward for the state union leaders, too. As MFT President Sandra Peterson said in her September 2011 interview, the states were very independent. Even though Shanker was up there talking about all this stuff, he'd throw the ideas out to see which ones would stick. But each state had their own leadership and would make their own decisions, and they were not buying charter schools. Shanker was such a strong leader. Everybody on the AFT board certainly expressed their opinions and concerns about charter schools. Minnesota chartering supporters took the concept of Shanker's charter school and ran with it in a different way. There are some schools that are probably carrying out what he was thinking about, but they're outside the district. I think we should be doing this inside school districts. Our members were very threatened. We had votes against charter schools. That's why, even though we might support Shanker's forward thinking and Amber, who said this is to avoid vouchers, we lobbied her a lot about not doing this. How ironic. My original motivation for pursuing chartering legislation was to empower teachers. Back in 1988, and again 3 years later, Shanker's comments affirmed this as a laudable goal. But in Minnesota, teachers saw charters as threatening to all, not empowering for some. And they were aggressively pushing back. How could we ever break through the great fear being generated among their colleagues? I once read this acronym definition of fear: false evidence appearing real. There is nothing harder to overcome than fear.